So I'll just start by saying this is Rosemary Hall, recording on behalf of the Dialect and Heritage Project. It's Sunday the 9th of October 2022. And could I ask you please to introduce yourself? Could I ask you to introduce yourself?
Oh, I'm Betty Borthwick, daughter of Professor Harold Orton of Leeds University and his wife, Joan Burnham. And I am speaking to Rosemary as she asked me to say a few words about the dialect survey and its beginnings.
Thank you. Wonderful, yeah. Betty, what was it like to be the daughter of Harold Orton?
Well, it was adventurous. He was a very outgoing person, and you know, he loved talking to anybody who happened to be even sitting in a cafe beside, on a table beside us, because he was a good mimic, and he would like to mimic the people speaking all round him, which was highly embarrassing for a small child who was obviously related to this man who was speaking to everybody in a cafe or restaurant or anything, because he just liked meeting people, which was very helpful for his great life project of the Survey of English Dialects, which began long ago when he was a boy in a mining village of Byers Green in County Durham, where he was brought up by his father, who was the headmaster of the local school, and his mother, who was, as all women were then, housewives, battling, trying to feed and clothe children at the time. So,
did your father talk much about his childhood?
Not a great deal, because he was the third of four children, and I think partly because he had a little sister who was 3 years younger than he was, and my grandmother, who was not a very, I don't think one could say, healthy woman, and needed a lot of help with the looking after the four children. And my grandfather was the headmaster of the local school and choir master of the local church.
So we're just looking at a photograph of him now.
Yes.
Wow. Mm-hmm.
And he was a miner's son.
Your grandfather?
My grandfather, yes. And he battled away to get a good education. And I don't know whether he actually went himself to Durham University or not, but three of his four children, he got them into the university there. So it was a bit of a fight. And my aunt, his youngest daughter, remembers him up all part of the night studying away to get further qualifications and things. And he was a great believer in girls' education. I mean, that would have been sort of 1890s and so on, and he believed in education for girls. which I expect was quite unusual, and I've no idea whether he had brothers and sisters. I've absolutely no idea. I've never told anything about that. My grandmother certainly had Uncle Tom, who was her brother, and she had cousins and so on, but of him I absolutely know nothing at all.
Did you meet him?
Oh, yes. Yes, I didn't like him. But he had these horrible moustaches, and he would enjoy getting me to kiss him when I met him, because he could then rasp his moustaches on my face. So I didn't like him at all. And he was a very bad-tempered man. Not surprising, because he'd had to work his way up. And I know that he had digestive problems, which wouldn't have helped. When he was the kind of man who, if he didn't like what had been cooked for a family main meal, threw it out and threw it over the table.
What was your father's relationship with him like?
Well, he respected his father, but none of them liked the way he treated their mother. He believed in walloping children once if they misbehaved, just once in their lives. And he believed if you did that once, the children would always do what they were told. And when my father and his brother joined up in, I suppose, 1915 something, all he said to them was, if you do anything you would be ashamed to speak to your mother about, don't come home. It was that really rigid moral stand that he took, which must have been very difficult for the children, because they were devoted to their mother.
Tell me about your father's education.
Well, my grandfather was the headmaster of the village school at Byers Green, which is a little mining village in Durham. And he was sent to school at the age of three with his older brother, who was four, because of the baby. So they started off in the same form at school. And I think this was pretty hard on my uncle, because my father was, unfortunately for him in these circumstances, cleverer than his older brother. I mean, they were devoted brothers all their lives. But I mean, it didn't help when you were sent to school and you were about six in the same class as your older brother, who was seven. And your older brother was being taught exactly like you. So they went from the village school to King James the Sixth Grammar School, which I think was in Bishop Auckland. They went by train. Well, there was a train network over the whole country. So they went by train to school. And my grandfather and grandmother, these, to their one relaxation day, was going to sing in the choir from They would go from Byers Green to Spennymoor, and they sang in the church choirs there. That was their one night out in the week.
And then after grammar school, for your father?
He and my uncle went to Durham University, and my father would have been just 17 when he went to university. And I think he had probably just about a year because of the First World War. You know, they were called up. So they both had a year at university before they were called up. So my father was doing English and my uncle was doing maths. And then they had to was called up. My uncle was certainly in the trenches, and then joined the Royal Flying Corps, it was called then, and my father was sent out to France, of course, and he was very badly wounded just 2 days before his 19th birthday. And that's when he was, his arm was completely shattered with a bullet through it. And even when I was a little girl, he was still wearing this splint which held his hand like that and came up his arm and held his hand in a usable way because he refused to have his arm amputated as they wanted to. But he wouldn't have that. So he was fortunate and was in hospital in Oxford at Somerville College, which had this ward for the wounded officers. And that's where he spent, I suppose, about a year and a half, I think. And when he was out of the hospital, he had a high splint which kept his arm like that, so that the circulation of blood came down it.
Did he talk, did he talk much about his experiences during the war?
Not to me. He talked to my cousin John, who was the same age as me, but he talked to John because that was a man, you know. And he didn't talk to my mother about it until the year he died, which was when 1975. Mm-hmm. And he spoke then about it, but he wouldn't have talked otherwise to her unless it was, you know, he was getting really quite elderly then.
What's your earliest memory of your father?
Well, I was told that I was very interested in seeing him shaving because people then had shaving brushes. And I said to my mother, "Daddy's boiling over." But I don't remember saying that. But because I was a bronchial child, and I was often ill in the winter time. I couldn't really run very far or anything like that, and he was very keen on me being active, and his ambition for me was for me to go to Oxford. He'd gone to Merton College as a wounded officer. and went to Merton College, and he was very keen on me to go to Somerville. But I dutifully applied to go there, but I got a place at what is now St. Anne's College and had a lovely time in Oxford for 3 years.
Can you tell me a bit more about your father's time at Merton?
His
time at Merton?
His
time at Oxford? You said that
Oh, yes. Well, he was in this ward in Somerville College, and they brought in a man who'd been shot through the lungs, who couldn't speak, and they didn't know what to call him, because he was just brought in and dumped in an empty bed. And my father said, "I know, we'll call him George." So they called him George, and he became my godfather. And he was the Archdeacon of Coventry. He was a superman and a very great friend of my father and mother. And I think my father enjoyed himself very much. His room in Merton College was in the archway above the entrance to the college, and so they could drop things on their friends passing underneath if they wished. And he went punting and all sorts of things like that, although he could really just use one arm properly. And I think that, you know, made a huge difference to him, because he couldn't turn over a page with his right hand. And he couldn't write with his right hand. He had to learn to write with his left hand. So he had to turn the page left-handed and then write down. And his writing was queer because, of course, he had to learn to write with his left hand. And he preferred to write with a pencil. And that was a big, awkward thing, really. Because, of course, you couldn't easily write with a fountain pen or a dipping pen, because this stuff, you know, if you're going across left-handed, you smeared things if you weren't very careful. So everything he was doing took, as it were, twice as long as anybody else. And I'm sure that affected the speed with which he could work and things. You know, was not having full use of his right hand.
When he was at Merton, was he studying?
In Oxford, yes, when he went to Merton. Henry Cecil Wilde was his the big man he worked with. And he was a favoured student of Henry Cecil's, and he also was very musical, and he'd played the piano very well as a child. But of course, with this business, he couldn't play so well, but he wondered if he could play the organ, because he tried to play the organ. I mean, he played it in the church before when he was a child. And he thought he could maybe do a lot more, and he went to see Hubert Parry, a composer, and talked it over with him, and they decided that he really couldn't, because of his disability, he really couldn't play anything other than just for enjoyment.
Yes. What happened after Oxford?
And in Oxford, he did English, he read English language and literature. And from there, he went to Sweden, to Uppsala. And he went as an English lector. And he was in Sweden from 1922 to 1925. And enjoyed it very much, And my mother went out to join him. Well, they got married in December 25, and she went out with him, and they had, well, she had 2.5 years altogether in Sweden, and he had 4.5. And Sweden was his, as it were, foreign language, because I went with him to a conference of linguists in Paris in 1948. And my father would start off speaking French to the taxi drivers and things, but it turned into Swedish without him realizing it. It was quite funny. That was his foreign language.
How did you come to be going to Paris with him to a conference?
Oh, because I went to Oxford, and there was this big conference, and he thought it'd be fun for me to go with him to this linguists conference, this big conference. And then he was going on, I think, to America after that, and I was going to Oxford anyway. So it worked out quite well that he and I went to this conference, and I chatted away to various professors of this and that.
What do you remember about it?
Well, it was fun, and I enjoyed it. I went to quite a lot of lectures, sat beside what was going to be my professor of French afterwards. And according to my father, this my about-to-be professor said that my greeting smile to him lit up the conference. But, I mean, I never spoke to him after that, because that was, I was too shy to have spoken a lowly student from St. Anne's. Couldn't really talk to a professor like that.
Did you travel at other times with your father?
Well, that was the only time I did. Otherwise, my mother was always, going with him. They spent a lot of, half the year in America. He had teaching stints at various American universities, teaching dialectology and phonetics and things like that.
So you didn't go to America with him ever?
No, I never went to America. No.
And Betty, where did you grow up?
Well, I was born in late August in Suffolk, where my grandfather, not this one, but my mother's father, was the rector of a little parish outside Ipswich called Trimley St. Mary. And I was born there in the late summer after they came back from Sweden. And then when I was 3 weeks old, my parents and I went up to Newcastle, where my father had a job as a lecturer in English at what was Armstrong College and is now the University of Newcastle.
And how long were you based in Newcastle?
Until the day war broke out, when we went to Sheffield. My father was in charge of the Department of English in Sheffield. Nobody else in the department, it was just him. With people being called up, everything. And we were in Sheffield all through the war till 1946.
What was that like?
Well, it wasn't much fun being in the Sheffield Blitz, but Sheffield was okay, but the school I was sent to, which would be the Sheffield Girls Public Day School Trust, it was then, Sheffield Grammar School. I really hardly remember that because we were evacuated to Baslow in Derbyshire, and it was not a very happy experience. The poor headmistress of the school we were evacuated to, the Young Men's Training College for, I don't know whether it was very much a church institute things, and this girls' school was just plonked into this men's training college with more or less no warning, and the poor headmistress of this girls' school was plonked into a men's college with, everything was, all the bathroom places were all as done for men, which was jolly difficult for everybody. There was no privacy of any kind, really. And we just had to be taken out for afternoon walks because it was just really almost totally disorganized. And our headmistress was plonked onto the apartment for the men's college, head of the college, and just had to share his accommodation until she could find somewhere else. And I don't know whether you know Derbyshire at all, do you, all that bit? No. Well, there are these fields with stone walls, and there's just a little open gate that you can go through, which is a very slim gate. And we had one very stout member of staff who would be in charge of our walks, and she couldn't get through. You can imagine somebody being stout enough that she couldn't get through this tiny gap in the wall. So we all streamed through this into the field, and she was squawking away on the roadside, telling us what to do and come back. And that's enough, girls, come on.
So how long was that period of time?
Well, I was only there for a term because I got dreadful bronchitis and had to be brought home. And I went to a Catholic school, a convent school, which was in the Fulwood part of Sheffield. Fortunately, it wasn't in the bit that was being bombed. But you could come in the morning and open the curtain and look down over Sheffield, and you could see the fires over the Sheffield factory area, steelworks. And you would go to a bus stop near the steelworks, and the girls who were working in the factories had newspaper bound round their legs to stop the steel dust stuff getting into their legs.
What age would you have been around that time?
I would have been 11.
And when do you think you became aware of your father's interest in dialect?
Oh, probably when I was about 5 or 6, because he would go off dialect hunting. And one year, because it coincided with half term, it must have been the October holiday that term, and my mother and I went with him for the first time, and we stayed in a little house in the village, it was all very exciting. And we went to watch the hound trails, where they had a man who went round on the route that the hounds were to take with an aniseed cloth and laid the trail on the ground so the hounds would come out and follow it, and we would watch the hounds setting off. There'd be a long line of hounds with their owners, and they would set off, and we would then go to the place where they were coming, the sort of stopping place, and you'd wait and wait, and then suddenly you would see various single dogs coming over the hill, and then they would rush down the hill and along to the place where they could see their owners, and then they went straight to the owners and were given a bowl of water and I think something to eat. And it was very exciting watching them come down singly and race to the final stopping place.
Mind the microphone there.
Is it okay?
Yeah,
I think so.
So, what village would that have been and where?
Well, that was in Northumberland, and it would have been, well, it must have been 1938 or 39.
And can you tell me more about the dialect hunting?
Oh, that was, I suppose they probably had to start doing that when they were still using, having to go by buses, because they didn't have a car until, I suppose, about 1936, 37, when we got the first car, which was MM something or other, and we called it Murky Miranda. It's unheated, and it was jolly cold in the autumn and spring. We had to have rugs and water bottles, and of course we had the dog with us as well, and it kept us warm a bit. It really was quite an ordeal.
And how would you hunt for dialect on these trips?
Well, it was, of course, my father, this is what we called it, dialect hunting. And what he would be doing, they would be picking a village which was really fairly isolated. And he would have to go to the local pub and chat to the people in the pub and find out who were the villagers who had not been out of the village. Because that was quite important then. And my father was a staunch teetotaler, so it's quite an ordeal for him to go into pubs. But he loved talking to people anyway, so that didn't bother him really.
Would he tell you about the people that he'd met?
I don't suppose he would really, because that was a side of him that, you know, when I was very young, we didn't sort of realise what he was doing, but we knew it was called dialect hunting because that's really what it was. He was finding the oldest inhabitants who had not really been out of the village, and he would find out quite early on that it was the women who tried to speak proper because they were trying to push the family up, and it was the men who were doing the work, really, where you found the old words and the variations of the words. And he decided, I think, very early that the best thing to do was to get them to speak and not as was quite common among these dialectologists, particularly I'd say in Scotland, that they sent postcards out to people and asked them to write down what they called various things, whereas he was always adamant that you should not speak the word yourself, but you should get them to answer the question in a way that they had to say the word that you wanted.
What happened after Sheffield? Where did you move after that?
Sheffield, we went from Newcastle to Sheffield, and then in 1946 he moved to Leeds.
How did that come about?
Well, he by that time was in full flow about all these the dialect surveys, and he knew what he wanted, but he's tried to get money to support him from the what we call the British ass. And various big firms, and he got a lot of support in Leeds from one of the textile owners. It was, you know, there were big mills in Leeds, and one of the men there got very keen on all this stuff, and he got a lot of support from him, including length of cloth to make a suit for him, because this was just, you know, after the war, and he didn't have what this man thought was a three-piece suit to go and get money from the dignitaries all over the country and whatnot. And it was ginger. Oh, it was a hideous thing. My mother and I cringed. Oh, golly, ginger tweed. Three-piece suit.
So did he know this person before he got the job at Leeds, or how did he come to...
No, this was after he'd come to Leeds. He went to the... whatever is it called? That Association of English-speaking people. Oh, I've forgotten its name. But it was very...
Do you mean the Yorkshire Dialect Society?
No. No, it was one of those all over the country. Oh, forgotten its name completely. But it was a kind of association of business men and academics. And they would have lunches, working lunches and things. And he got a lot of support from them. And he found it difficult. I was telling Catherine, it would seem ridiculous now, but he was very conscious of the fact that he had not gone to a public school. And he found it difficult to get support from a lot of the high-ups in the people down in London and so on, because he hadn't been to a public school.
Did he talk about that to you?
Mm?
Did he talk to you about that?
Well, it talk was going on in the house and things.
So do you remember when his Survey of English Dialects project started?
Well, it started, it must have been when I was very little, because it was always in his mind that this is what he wanted to do. And he'd done that book, The Phonology of a South Durham Dialect. That was the thing which he'd been doing in, I suppose, in the early 1920s. That's what he did in Sweden and so on. And he got a lot of interest and support for a long time from Professor Sarkerson, who was, I think, in Uppsala. And we used to get students coming across from Sweden to stay with us for the summer.
What was that like?
That was fun. We liked that. You know, they came and stayed. And nearly always in the summer we had somebody from somewhere, people from Yale, Professor Kirkeritz, Helga Kirkeritz, who was at Yale, and he would come and stay part of the summer with us, and Eugen Diet from Zurich. And there was a very nice student from there who stayed with us. And you know, I remember these people coming and going. There's always a lot of activity.
Did you ever meet any of your father's colleagues from the School of English?
From
Leeds, from the department?
They did come, because there were a lot of, you know, people. Peter Wright was one, and John Widdowson, I think that's the name, isn't it, who was in Sheffield, and they were my father's students at Leeds, and because they were sent out, and they were doing a lot of the dialect research stuff, and Stanley Ellis, Martin something or other.
Martin Wakelin?
Yes, yes.
So, what was Peter Wright like?
Well, he was very shy with us, with my mother and me. Very quiet, and I think my father felt he needed to be given a bit more oomph. But I think he was felt that Eugen Dieck was a very strong personality, and I think he probably put these young men, Eugen Dieck was powerful, and he put these young men a bit on their best, they're trying to get the best out of them, and I think they found him a bit intimidating.
And Stanley?
Stanley, nothing would intimidate him, I don't think.
What was his relationship like with your father?
He was a very, Stanley was a very interested student. He had a nice little wife, and they had this caravan that they would live in and go around the country with it, because that was quite a good way of getting them both involved. And I think he was very helpful to my mother after my father died, because he died in the middle of getting things published and so on. There was a lot going on. I mean, my poor father said he saw words on the walls all round him. He was sort of haunted by them. And that was very difficult. When he was dying, and I just saw these words. And Stanley was very, very good to my mother at that time, and wrote a nice obituary of my father. But then my mother thought Stanley was, of course he was in a way taking over a lot of my father's things, and of course my mother was a bit, she wasn't exactly annoyed about it, but she didn't like him trying to step into Daddy's shoes, you know.
How did he do that?
Well, of course, there was all that stuff with the Yorkshire Ripper and things, you know. And Stanley thought he could be as good as my father was at identifying where people came from through their accents and quirks. But he wasn't.
So did you follow Stanley's career yourself?
No, because I didn't do English. My father said that it would be a great mistake if I did English. And so I did French and German, and then got married, and then we came up here, so I was really well out of the way.
What do you think the project, the whole survey of English dialects, what do you think it meant to your father?
Well, it just meant everything to him. It's what he'd been driving himself towards, I think, possibly all his life. And so everything gave way to the survey of English dialects and things. And we had people staying with us the whole of the holidays, and my mother was, never left to enjoy a holiday, because my father just didn't take them. And the work just took over completely.
Did he talk about his work much?
Well, yes. Because he was, my mother was interested. Well, she couldn't be anything other than interested, really, in what was going on. because just our life revolved around it.
Did you ever visit your father's office? Did you ever go onto campus?
Did I ever go
onto campus to his office?
Well, I didn't, because I was, I did a completely different subject, and I was in Oxford, and I'd also been at boarding school, so I was away from it. I found it a bit overwhelming.
How do you mean?
Well, that my father was so heavily involved, of course, with all this survey. That's what he was. His life was bound up in these dialects, and I just didn't see very much of him because he was always working. Never stopped working.
Wow. How would your father celebrate milestones, whether with publication or field work or?
Well, he enjoyed field work enormously, but of course once he'd got to Leeds and was able to set up the survey properly, he didn't really have so much time to go out into the field, which he would have loved to have done. Because all his time was devoted to the organizations of things and getting his students interested and getting the best of them to go out into the field. And he would go around and see how they were getting on.
If there was a fire and your father had to rescue one thing from that archive, what do you think he would save? If there were a fire in the archive and your father could only rescue one thing, what do you think it would be?
Oh, gosh. That's very difficult. I think possibly he would have rescued at least one of the questionnaire books, because that was such a job to draw up the questionnaire. So you had to decide what you wanted. Obviously, there was the had the sort of agricultural bit, because that was the basics stuff, and involved the words for ordinary life and everything. So you had to do that. You had to set up the questionnaire, and that took several years to get it done properly, because of the way they worked, which was obviously the best way to do it, was to get the right question where you would get the answer you wanted without the person realizing it. That was what was wanted, and that was very tricky.
What would you say was the spirit of the project?
Spirit of it. I think a lot of it was catching the moment between how people had lived and done things for hundreds of years and how it was changing. They got the point of change from the old ways to this new industrial concept. and it was important. They were very conscious. He was very conscious of seizing the moment when the change was happening.
Thank you. And what does it mean to you to know that your father created this survey that is still hugely important to linguists today?
Well, it is very important because it's a tribute to his work.
And what do you hope to see in the future?
Well, it's such a different world now. And a whole lot has been lost, I feel. And, of course, we were, at the time, in Britain was kind of isolated, wasn't it? There wasn't this great coming and going with the continent. In fact, we rather despised the continent because they weren't British.
What
couldn't trust them.
What does dialect mean to you personally?
Dialect?
Mm.
Well, it's just a language, a language of its own. I think they got it at the right time, before it got, well, you can't say spoiled, but before there was too much outside influence coming into it. They got it at the time when it was still really confined to this island.
You were, before we started recording, you were telling me a funny story about your father and the dog.
Oh, well, <they'd laughs> yes, well, he'd gone down to London, and he was talking, it was these BBC talks that he was doing just before the war, and you know, there was the HMV records, his master's voice, with that picture of the dog listening to the master's voice, and he asked my mother and me if we would get Bill, our dog, into the room when he was broadcasting from London on the BBC, this BBC talk, and see if the dog recognised his voice over the airways. And we said, no, he didn't know what it was. So that was a disappointment.
That's a brilliant story. Yes. Do you remember much of the media engagement that he used to do?
Well, I just was, you know, a little girl, and he was just going off to London to give these talks on the BBC. And I do remember, you know, that he was able to bring home, I suppose, from the university, a wireless, you know, with the little antenna sticking up, come and listen to this. It must have been when my father was away, and we had this wireless on loan while he was away, and listening to this voice, and it was Daddy's voice coming through. That was extraordinary, because I had these microphones on of my ears, and it was really extraordinary. The first time I'd ever heard that. very, very odd. Couldn't understand how it worked.
And what about the recording equipment that the project used to use?
Well, it was quite. I think I need a bit more milk in there. It took up a lot of room in a little house. Just think it, in a pre-war house, 1928 house. They were not big. And they had an integral garage in these houses in Newcastle, Jesmond Park West. 22, some number like that, anyway. And we didn't have a car, and my father decided he would prefer to have a dining room. So we had a dining room and a study and a drawing room downstairs with the kitchen, and then upstairs was the bathroom and three bedrooms. Yes, be three bedrooms.
Amazing. Betty, should we take a break?
Mm-hmm.
Should we have a break?
Yes.
Yeah?
Yes.
It's been such a privilege recording these memories. Thank you.